This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series.
I would like to introduce a quite brilliant writer. He's a former Bristol Con guest of honour. Yes, and you. And he's also officially the nicest man in the world. So could I please have a lovely big round of applause for Paul Cornell?
Whenever anybody introduces me as the nicest man in the world, I always want to come out to the mic and go, talking of which, can anybody have a quick look into the other bar and see if there are any children there? Because there are a few naughty words in this.
I'm far enough away.
They need to learn
sometime. Okay, cool.
can't be any worse than Gareth.
Yes.
I've got a T-shirt with that on. You can't be any worse than Gareth. But now, I'm going to read tonight from a work in progress, chiefly, the third Shadow Police novel. The first two, London Falling and The Severed Streets, are out as we speak. And I've just delivered the first draft of the third one. Hopefully it's out in December. And I'll tell you the title as we're about halfway into this, because it will become obvious what it should be called, and it is. A little bit of background. In the world of the Shadow Police novels, London has memory, and it remembers, the city remembers things that have happened in it, whether they be fictional or real. So the most haunted house in London, well, our heroes discover, even though it's just a bunch of made-up stories, is a terrifying, awful place. It works like that. So there are ghosts of real people and there are ghosts of fictional characters. And our heroes, four members of an undercover squad of the Metropolitan Police, have gained the ability to see all the secret horrors and monsters of London. As we start, Detective Constable Kevin Sefton has been awoken from his sleep by a terrifying dream and has used his basic attempts at divination in order to make his way to 221B Baker Street, the Sherlock Holmes Museum. The interior of the museum was exactly what he'd expected. A ticket booth, followed by a narrow staircase, with captions pointing out exactly how authentic every piece of bric-a-brac was. Sefton felt uneasy as the curator, a junior who'd been vacuuming an ice cream stain in the hall that wasn't budging, she told him, led him upstairs to Holmes's flat on the first floor. This was the sort of building Sefton and his team were getting used to exploring, with every detail of its history shouting at them because they had the site. Only this one had been designed that way for ordinary people and had nothing of the actual site about it. No real home, even that of an eccentric Victorian detective, would have this much significant detail. They'd laid it out like nobody ever threw anything away or cleaned up. The items on display were props, fakes. That was why it all felt so nauseating to someone with a sight. None of these items sung with it as they should. The house felt vulnerable, compromised, almost inviting, the sort of horror Sefton and his friends often saw in these places without realising it was doing so, inviting it, or perhaps, thought Sefton suddenly, making it. The curator unlocked and let him into the consulting room, asking lots of questions which suddenly Sefton couldn't hear, because now all his attention was taken up with what was in the centre of the room. Between a settee and a bearskin hearthrug, there lay the body of a man. He wore a deerstalker and one of those short capes. He lay on his back, one arm stretched out in what looked like a helpless plea toward the smaller of two desks in the corners of the room. Sticking out of his chest was a straight knife with some sort of decoration on the blade. The weapon tugged at Sefton with the gravity of the sight. It was the only thing here that did so. Around the body had formed a pool of blood. "What's that knife doing there?" asked the curator, puzzled. She obviously couldn't see the body, or her reaction would have been much more urgent. Sefton dared to take a step nearer and look down into the face of the dead man only he could see, a face which was changing, shifting continuously as Sefton watched. This was what had suddenly gone missing from London. His dream hadn't required any interpretation. He was at a crime scene, and the crime was the murder of Sherlock Holmes. Now, it's a chapter ending. The title of the book is Who Killed Sherlock Holmes? about a little more about where our heroes are in this book. They're in a very bad way. After the events of book two, they're at odds with each other. Ross has magically lost her ability to feel happiness. So she's kind of dark. Quill has discovered an awful secret he doesn't want to share with anybody else, and so is suffering from stress leading to mental illness. And Costain has lost the love of Ross and is feeling bleak and stoic. So Sefton, who's the only one with who's still got a basically joyful attitude on life, when they arrive at this crime, when he summons his fellows to the crime scene, he's hoping it will bring them all together. So let me continue with the next chapter. It took little persuasion for the curator to accept that this was a crime scene. She'd seen enough procedural TV shows to understand that evidence could be invisible to the naked eye, and the knife in the floor had startled her. Everything had been normal, she said, when she'd locked up at this room around 11 p.m. Sefton got her to call her bosses, which meant her leaving a message on their answer phone, which was brilliant, because that meant that in the early hours, after first Quill and then Ross and then Costain had arrived, and Sefton had interviewed the curator, taken her contact details and sent her home, the team had the place to themselves. Quill stared at the body, as if this were some mad joke being played on him. He looked, if possible, even more burdened. Before Sefton could ask if something had happened, he was all business. Is he solid? No, Jimmy, Sefton demonstrated, sticking the toe of his shoe right through the body's head. They all knew that the ghosts formed by London remembering a real or fictional character had varying degrees of solidity. This time, they couldn't examine the corpse, couldn't even turn it over. Sefton had already taken a lot of photos using his phone, then checked that, to a sighted person, the body did show up on them. The image of the body was still multifaceted, changing as you looked at it, changing with the angle. It was, Sefton had realised, a combination of all the different Sherlocks, all the different actors, including Speke, Flamsteed and Creed, three actors who are filming three productions of Sherlock Holmes at the same time in London as the story takes place. Lots of actors he didn't recognise, some in modern dress, many wearing the deerstalker and cape, which thus had a regular shape compared to the flickering of the rest of the image, and also a sort of pencilled version, which Sefton realised must be the strong memory created by the original illustrator of the Holmes stories, whose name Sefton couldn't remember. That additive flavour, which, after a moment, he realised reminded him of an ancient Aha Pop video. That thought had led to him filming the body on the phone, until he was sure he'd caught the full cycle of incarnations as they flickered by. No habeas corpus, then, said Ross, which might have been a joke, except there was, as ever, no humour in her expression. How is this even possible? Asked Costain, who looked like he might have wanted to make a few dark jokes himself, but was, as always, restraining every expression who he was for Ross's sake. Well, said Sefton, who'd had a while to think about this, if you mean, how is there a Sherlock Holmes, then I think it's obvious that there would be, or was, in our version of London. London remembers things that happened, but like we saw with the most haunted house at Berkeley Square, it equally remembers stuff that was just made up. Sherlock Holmes, a very popular fictional character with a huge link to London, a lot of people even think he's real. There's been Holmes mania, with the three versions filming at once in town, getting everyone thinking about it, said Ross. It's actually kind of obvious he'd be one of our ghosts. If you mean, how do you kill a ghost, Sefton continued, you've got me there. Why haven't we seen him before? Costain had stepped closer to the body. Where's he associated with, said Ross, a rhetorical question, talking to herself, though Costain had looked up hopefully for a moment at the thought she might actually have addressed him. Just this building. The ghost of Jack the Ripper, in the last book, was in Whitechapel. Every other place associated with Sherlock Holmes, is it Dartmoor in Hound of the Baskervilles? Yeah, said Quill, and there's the Reichenbach Falls, wherever that is. Not in London, said Ross. Yeah, I fucking knew that, said Quill, startling her. Then a beat later, sorry. Sefton found himself frowning. That wasn't the Quill he knew. He hoped, but later for that. Costain was shaking his head like he fundamentally didn't believe what he was seeing. Ghost body, ghost weapon, no, this is fucked up. He reached out the toe of his own shoe towards the dagger, and to Sefton's surprise, it connected. I hadn't tried that, he said, feeling a little irked that he'd missed something that was in his own speciality. To kill a ghost, you need a special weapon, and that would have to be a real object. Makes sense. Also, a ghost weapon would surely not have had that sighted weight to it. Ross stepped to the edge of the pool of blood and, with a reluctance born of many tangible crime scenes, put her finger in the liquid. "Blood isn't real," she said. She stepped into it to squat by the blade and waved aside the start of a warning from Quill. "We can't disturb something that isn't here. This weapon is solid evidence." She took out her phone to take some closer pic photos of what Sefton had initially taken for decoration, but now could make out as a tiny row of what looked like stick men engraved on the blade. "There's an obvious question here. Is this coincidental to the study in Scarlet Murder, a copycat case, or is there a link? There has been earlier a murder in London with the word rash written on the wall in blood. You said you felt like something had gone missing from London," Quill said to Sefton. "That Holmes came to you in a dream. Did someone do this? Is this murder? Now we're wondering if ghosts commit suicide," murmured Costain, as if somebody had to say it. "What do you mean, Jimmy?" asked Sefton. He didn't like that sound in Quill's voice, familiar from his own experience. He was used to the voices of organised crime network bosses, that edgy mix of authority and paranoia. "I mean, maybe it's London saying something to us. Maybe this is, you know, symbolic." "That is the first time I've ever heard you use that word," said Costain. He was looking as uneasy as Sefton was, trying to find some banter here. Quill slowly shook his head. "The death of Sherlock Holmes. He's deduction. He's the idea you can, you know, pick apart something that's happened, find meaning to it, solve it. Maybe we're getting to the end of that being possible. Maybe soon nothing will mean anything." He suddenly artificially laughed, as if he realised how unlike his old self he sounded. "Cheerful thought, actually, then we can retire, go somewhere nice." His smile faded again. Ross made an audible clicking sound with her tongue, as if adding an annoyed full stop to an idea she wasn't willing to entertain. She got out her notebook. "I'm going to start recording all the details," she said, as if Quill hadn't spoken. "What about the rest of the room?" Sefton was glad of her moving things on. He took the evidence gloves from his pocket and put them on, which made Costain and finally Quill do that too. They examined the crime scene. Sefton had taken it to be undisturbed, but they swiftly found quite a few worrying changes to what a guidebook photo indicated was the norm. It was hard to see, but on one of the walls was drawn in chalk an upright rectangle, as if someone was planning to build a doorway there. "Look at this," said Costain. "Like Ballard used to get into the bank." There's also a bank raid at the start. "So other people have something that can do that," said Sefton. "That speaks of a suspect leaving the scene." In front of the grate of the fireplace, there was a strange, rather theatrical shoe with faded blue, gold and red details, the toe of which was upturned. There was a hole in it, and from its side had poured a trail of what, with a sniff and the withholding of a sneeze, Sefton identified as tobacco. A pile of the stuff beside it had been formed into a spiral shape. "Bloody spiral," said Quill, sounding suddenly like he'd solved the case. Ross immediately came over and said it didn't look anything like the spiral patterns the witch Maura Losley had left behind her, and besides, those were made of soil. She sounded like she wanted to add that Quill should have noted those things. "That'd be a Persian slipper," said Costain, looking at the guidebook and diverting Quill from Ross's glare. The hole in said footwear looked like it had been cut. Sefton took a picture. As he did so, he glanced up and noticed something else. On the mantelpiece above the fireplace, there was a drawing of a woman in Victorian costume. There was something about her eyes. He stood and looked more closely. They each had the tiniest of pinpricks made in them. It made it look like the woman's gaze was following you, but in an askew way. Under the drawing was a caption, "Irene Adler." Sefton pointed the holes out to Ross, who was now writing at high speed. "The woman in Holmes's life," said Costain. "You ever read any of the stories?" asked Sefton. "When I was a kid. She's in a lot of the films and TV shows, isn't she?" Beside the photograph, in the centre of the mantelpiece, was embedded a large knife. It had caught Sefton's gaze on his first inspection of the room, but it was pictured in the guidebook, so he gathered it was a feature of the room as it should be. It held a bundle of letters, with a 221B address at the top of the first one. Sefton leafed through them and noticed something. "Here, look at this." The others gathered around. Only the first two letters were complete, the top one being a fun appeal for help from somebody who'd lost their cat, the second one a letter from somebody complaining to Holmes about the noise of his violin playing. Both of them had a series of tiny holes punched in them, sometimes taking letters, sometimes not. The holes were also present in the blank sheets that made up the rest of the pile. Not going through from the letters above them, but cut in different patterns, after which they must have been put back under the knife. "What the living fuck?" said Costain. He was shaking his head. He checked the guide again, but couldn't find any reference to this being something from one of the home stories. Sefton let his gaze drift to the right and realised that what he thought was a globe of the world was something entirely different, on top of another cabinet in the corner. Besides lots of objects that were souvenirs of particular cases, sat what had once been, he took the guide from Costain and checked, a wax bust of Holmes's head. However, it was now just about unrecognisable. The features had been melted, the eyes were now streaks of colour down the pale face, the nose a stalactite with drips from it connecting to the wood below. Sefton reached out and found no heat near it. Raising a hand to keep the others back, he put a finger to the wax itself. It wasn't even warm. "We can get an expert opinion on that cooling," said Ross. "Get a time frame." "The curator," added Sefton, "said everything was normal at 11 p.m. That's the last time she looked in here. I had that dream maybe 5 minutes later. I was here by midnight." Maybe the dream was actually the moment Holmes died? He'd seemed to be desperately asking for help. "Over here," said Ross, moving on. She was pointing to a series of bullet holes in the wall above a pile of books beside Holmes's desk, which formed the letters VR. "I think that's an original feature." "It is," said Sefton, consulting the guide, "but this isn't." She was pointing at a series of thin red lines that connected several of the holes, sometimes crossing each other. "Looks like biro, not blood." She moved lights to photograph the lines clearly. Her brow had furrowed into a look Sefton appreciated. She had seen several patterns now. And though that brought her no pleasure, for both her and the rest of them, that was equivalent to her having seen the keys to a lock. "What's he pointing at?" said Quill, who had kept glancing back at the body. Indeed, now Sefton looked closely. The outstretched hand was flickering through some gestures that looked like pointing. He looked up in the direction Quill was and found the smaller desk in the corner opposite, with pictures of two men above it, one in military uniform, the other a man of proud appearance with white hair whipped back from his brow like a mad composer. "General Gordon, a contemporary of Holmes' British Army, died in the siege in the Sudan, and Henry Ward Beecher, an American anti-slavery preacher," said Costain, consulting the guidebook. "Or, as I suppose we can refer to them now, suspects." What was he working on? Quill had wandered to Holmes's own desk, to the left of which was pinned a map of the night sky, a diagram of the solar system, and an astronomical photo of lots of stars. He wasn't working on anything, said Ross. He's a fictional character in a museum. His ghost might have looked like it was working on something, but nothing remembered by London has agency, volition. "And yet," said Quill, "those charts and photo aren't in the guidebook. And you just made an assumption based only on the limited amount of shit we've seen." Ross looked relieved to be corrected. She glanced at Sefton. This was more like the Quill they knew. "Yes, boss." Quill unpinned the astronomical map, diagram and photo and inspected them more closely. On the back of the photo was something that made him call them over to see. In an elegant, precise hand, there was written, "The ultimate crime, I must solve it." That, said Sefton, would be a motive for murder. Holmes got too close to something. "Considering all the books and stuff," said Costain, "what would he think of as ultimate?" Ross was looking annoyed again. "I can't get used to the idea of him thinking," she said. "That's such an anomaly. It must mean something." "Maybe a ghost like Holmes would work on crimes," said Sefton. "That's what he was remembered for." He checked the handwriting against what Google could find. Quite a few people have had a go at doing Holmes's handwriting. They all look a bit like that, but we all sort of know what his writing would look like, don't we? "Where's Watson?" said Costain. Sefton wanted to smack himself on the forehead. That was the second time Costain had beaten him to the obvious. The sheer density of information in this murder room made seeing what was right in front of him bloody difficult. "Yeah, good point. If Holmes was well known enough to be a ghost and pinned down to this location, wouldn't Watson be too?" "Probably," said Ross. "Damn it, I hate probably." They all took a closer sighted look around the room, Sefton remembering what Costain had said to him about how hard to find some of the Ripper victim ghosts had been. Of Watson, however, there was no sign. "The curious case," said Sefton, "of the Watson who wasn't there." "Moriarty," said Ross, seemingly the instant the idea came to her. "Got to be suspect number one, surely. If you ask anyone the question, who killed Sherlock Holmes, that's the answer you will get." "Maybe," said Sefton, "except that Moriarty isn't as huge in the public imagination as Holmes is and isn't linked to a London location. I don't think he'd have a ghost." "Wait a sec." Quill had been looking off into the distance, the photo still in his hand. He was breathing hard, as if he'd just finished running. Something had come upon him, Sefton realised. He watched as Quill searched the desk beside the photo and found something else. "I think this was sent to him," he said. He picked up an empty envelope from the desk, compared the size of it to the photo, and showed them the card backing. The stamps on the front were modern and carried a London postmark. The letter was addressed to Sherlock Holmes at the famous address. "He must get a lot of fan mail," said Sefton. "Some fictional characters do. I wonder where it's kept." "We need another word with that curator," said Ross. "Whoever killed Holmes," said Ross, "left a room full of deliberate clues." That's a strike against Moriarty. His big thing was that you wouldn't suspect him of being a criminal, wasn't it? He took care not to leave clues. Sefton went back to the other side of the room, which held a bookcase containing volumes such as a reverse telephone directory and several bound volume collections, the spine of which indicated were Holmes's own monograph. Sefton opened one of them and was momentarily surprised to find the pages blank. They were, of course, like the letters, just props. There were some gaps in the rows of books. He looked on the desk for them, then around the room. He couldn't find them and indicated that to the others. Ross photographed the shelves and noticed the placing of the gaps. "Why would someone nick fake books?" she asked. "Maybe it was an opportunist. Robbery gone wrong," said Custain. She looked incredulously at him, then realised he was joking and turned away, took a couple of steps away from him, furious at him all over again. Sefton watched Custain's face fall, another small attempt to reach out, another indication that the connection between them had gone forever. He looked back to Quill, who was leaning on the wall, his expression far away. It was like he'd had an idea but had lost it. Sefton was suddenly angry, with himself as well and with them. Don't do that," he yelled. The others all turned to look at him. "You've stepped right back into going through the motions, filling your roles, and that's great, that's what we should be doing. But if we keep doing only that, we will run ourselves into the ground like we've already been doing for weeks now." "Kev," began Quill, aside his voice. "But look at this, look at it. It got to you when you saw that handwriting. I know it did. That's Sherlock bloody Holmes lying dead right there. This has to be a change in how London remembers stuff. If he doesn't just regenerate like a video game character or something like that. This is huge. Wait a sec." He checked his evidence gloves weren't torn, marched over, looked to Ross to check what he was about to do was okay, and a nod from her confirming that it was, pulled the blade from the flickering body. He half expected Holmes to flash back in existence and become once again what he must have been before, the wraith of an idea haunting these chambers, but he didn't. Sefton straightened up and held the murder weapon high in the air. "This is the ultimate murder mystery, and this room displays a ton of evidence. What more do you need to get excited about what only we do? What more do you need to bloody snap out of it, work together and be us again?" Custain was grinning at him, he realised, obviously relieved by what had been said, but still, Sefton was immediately a bit embarrassed at having made the closest thing to a stirring speech that he'd ever heard from anybody in the Met. "Kev, I mean it. Enough of the jokes from you." "No, I agree, and that's great. That's the best thing. But I just looked at the BBC News page," he held up his phone. "Another body's been found with Raish written on the wall. Do you want to say it, or will I?" "What? Mate, the game is afoot."
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.